Welcome to the Intelligence Hour, cutting-edge expose on the actions of government in light of the U.S. Constitution. I'm your host, former CIA officer Kevin Shipp, reporting to you from a secure studio somewhere deep in the southern United States. As always, I introduce the program with these questions. Do we now live under a post-constitutional government in this country? Is there really a shadow government, a massive system controlled by secrecy or a deep state that controls Washington, D.C. behind the scenes? Why does it seem like congressional hearings on government corruption never go anywhere? Why do government officials and the heads of major Wall Street corporations commit crimes and even lie under oath, but they're never charged, while Americans of lesser status are hit with maximum penalties? Why is the national news media not reporting on these important stories? These are the issues we deal with on this program every week, head on, with no conservative or liberal bias, no Republican or Democratic influence, and no manipulation by large corporate sponsors. At the Intelligence Hour here, we are free to talk about the truth in any direction that we want to go. The Intelligence Hour has one goal: to fulfill our constitutional responsibility to inform you, the American people, our audience, about the actions of your government. You are the voice of government by the people. You are the solution to restoring freedom, peace, and justice in this country. Because I believe in your courage and resolve to make a difference, I humbly take the risk every week to expose the unconstitutional actions of government when they occur. I do it because I adore this country, and I do it for the love of freedom. So sit back, relax on this Monday evening, and join me for a fascinating discussion on the current state of our government, considering the greatest governing document ever written by man, the United States Constitution. Tonight, I have as my guest, honored guest, retired Royal Canadian Mounted Police Inspector Bill Miker. Inspector Miker is a foremost expert on money laundering, global money laundering. He has extensive operational experience, including covert operations in the largest money laundering securities fraud investigation in North America. Canadian author Paul Polanco has written three bestsellers on the RCMP, which is the equivalent of the U.S. FBI, and has described Inspector Miker as one of the most celebrated police officers in the history of the Mounties, known for both his daring and his success. Inspector Miker is an expert on what he calls professional kleptocracy. In other words, stealing and hiding large sums of money, which literally rules the world. This complex world of money laundering is understood by only a few. Inspector Bill Miker is a legend and has worked some of the largest actual global money laundering cases in history. Inspector Miker, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. You know, Inspector, I want to talk to you tonight about an important issue that's been out there for quite some time, been in the press going all the way back to 2007, all the way up especially to 2012, and that is the HSBC Bank, which, as we know, has been one of the largest money laundering banks in the world. And I understand that you had an investigation going on that crossed the paths of HSBC Bank, relating to some money laundering with Muammar Gaddafi's funds from his regime. During your investigation, apparently you found, based on your investigation, that the UN and the World Bank were contributing to, potentially, to terrorist financing cases. During that investigation, Inspector Miker, what did you come across, or what did you find?
Well, there's a lot of overlap there, and it was two points. I had already left government when, in 2014, I was dealing with some people from the Middle East, a governmental level, and they said, "Look, Bill, we've come across what we believe is $13 billion belonging to Gaddafi." And as you know, 2012 is when he was deposed and executed.
Right.
But there's a vast sum. I mean, some allegations are as much as $180 billion of the country's wealth, which was effectively his, had disappeared. So again, whether that's in oil, gold, cash, but stories started popping up that the vast sums of both gold, physical gold, and physical cash had been sequestered mostly across Africa and the Middle East. And so these this one government from the GCC and said, look, we believe there's $13 billion that is sitting in a vault in West Africa. Can you ascertain? And the there was a colonel from the Libyan intelligence service who had supposedly conduct over this, and they had found a bank in Saudi Arabia, one of the foremost Islamic banks, that was willing to participate in bringing those funds into the banking system and then partitioning that money off to the beneficiaries. And so I flew into Saudi Arabia. I went into the Eastern province, and I met with one of the family members of this bank, and I was there with other people. And there was a French Libyan doctor who had been the interface, and he in fact was a physician to the king of Saudi Arabia. And going into that meeting, we started learning about the provenance of the gold and the funds. And this particular colonel was at that point in Aleppo in Syria, and the conflict in 2014 was just starting to heat up. So he wasn't able to make it to the meeting, but we still had the meeting nonetheless. We started talking about there being roughly $6 billion, $7 billion in cash, and at that point, about $5 billion in gold bullion. And so we talked about how we would legitimize the money, how we would look at bringing that money into the banking system. And this Islamic bank said, look, we don't want to bring it directly into Saudi Arabia, but we have a correspondent bank in the UAE that more comfortable if the money goes into that bank. The laundering fee on that, we're going to charge 30%. And so we determined the provenance, we determined the fee for the transaction, we determined how we were going to, we were just going to fly it out, and we're just waiting for this Libyan colonel. I flew out of Saudi the next day, and literally on that day is when it was the U.S. Senate Committee on Investigations, which had been investigating HSBC, announced the $1.9 billion fine, the money laundering involving HSBC, both out of Mexico and elsewhere, and the fact that they had moved money that went to Al-Qaeda as terrorist financing money with the very Islamic bank that I had met with the day before. Wow. So it's just a coincidence on the timing. But, you know, with all this stuff happening, you know, the Islamic bank didn't seem to care. They're still prepared to take blood money into their banking operation, mm-hmm. prepared to take the stealth steps so it didn't come in directly into Saudi. And so, you know, the world is what the world is. And then fast forward about 9 months, I get contacted by a former colleague of mine in the Mounties. In fact, he used to run our national undercover program. And he said, look, Bill, do you mind maybe doing a job for us? And he was working with under the what's called the STAR initiative, which is the Stolen Asset Recovery Initiative of the World Bank. And again, this whole thing was when there's kleptocracy or government theft and there's a regime change, it's really the people in the country that deserve the money, not the not that corrupt official or family member. So they on their own had developed an informant who became a cooperating witness that identified allegedly about $240 million of Gaddafi's money that was sitting in a bonded warehouse in Abidjan in the Ivory Coast. So this involved the bad guys, for lack of a better word, came out of Sudan, had connections to Qatar, and of course with the Ivory Coast government. Now, understand, this was 6 months after the civil war in the Ivory Coast. And so the country was getting back on its feet. And so I was asked if I would travel to the Ivory Coast and determine the legitimacy of these funds, and if in fact it was Gaddafi's money, to come up with a scenario that would allow us to recover those funds. And in fact, what we were going to do was fly the money out into Malta. But I'll tell the story. So I said, okay. So I agreed, and I developed a cover story and went into the Ivory Coast. I remember I flew in late at night. There was a yellow fever epidemic going on, so I had to deal with, you know, getting shots for that before I could exit the airport. But I think all they were looking for was a bribe. But I then went in, and I met these so-called government officials. In fact, it was a military officer from the Ivory Coast. And you notice at that time there was the peacekeepers from these different African countries. So you saw a lot of soldiers around. You saw a lot of different uniforms. And so I meet with the this general, and he says, yes, we have $240 million of Gaddafi's money. It's in a bonded warehouse under the title of emeralds from Mali. And we've got the Libyan seal on these crates, and the crates were probably about 3 feet by 4 feet, you know, big, almost square dimension. And again, wrapped in the Libyan seal. And when they pop it open, sure enough, it's all 100 US dollar bills, all clean, crisp. And we were able to extract a few of them. And in doing the extraction, we relayed the information. We were there for several days, relayed the information back to the cover team. And they were able, through the Secret Service, to determine that those were indeed legitimate U.S. dollar bills issued by the Federal Reserve. The only problem is they were issued 2 years after Gaddafi was already executed.
Wow.
So it's very clear that that wasn't Gaddafi's money. And so the one thing I noticed when I was there, you know, for operational security, I booked into one hotel, then did all my meetings at another hotel. And what I noticed at the one hotel is a kind of a ramshackle, one-story building that covered a bit of the city block. And it had a lot of armed security around there. And I observed that the uniforms being worn there were the same as who was guarding the money, you know, for what I was dealing with. And I asked, I said, what building is that? Oh, that's the central bank. And that's when the penny dropped. One of the things as we were doing this, I was asking them, what do you want to do with the money? And they were a bit ambivalent about it. They said, look, you need to pay $1.5 million to get it out of bond. It's been sitting there for a couple of years, you know. And I said, okay, no problem. We're going to bring a plane in and we'll fly this cash out and I'll pay you $2 million. Not a problem, but you're taking it off the back of the plane as we're going out. No. We need to have the money before you go. So very quickly, I'm realizing this is a bait and switch type of scheme.
Right.
But the money was real. And in one of those crates, they had three of them. It was 80 million U.S. dollars, all in U.S. $100 bills. And then again, from the central bank, the Civil War had happened 6 months before. West Africa and Ivory Coast is cash-based societies to a large degree. Not everybody has bank accounts and ATM machines. So it's very cash-based. And so the United Nations, as part of the regional donor aid money, says we will put all this cash so you can, you know, reflate your economy, get money moving around so bills can get paid, people get paid, and let's get the commerce going. But what you have here is corrupt officials who were using that money to do sort of scams, pure frauds. And in fact, it had been relayed to me that one of the rulers from the UAE had lost $50 million on such a scheme. So it paid and made a lot of money. I learned also before I went there, I did a little bit of homework, and I didn't realize that the Lebanese mafia are really the ones who control organized crime in West Africa. You know, we're very familiar with the Nigerian scams and the like. But in fact, the hotel I stayed at, which was Sofitel, you know, laying out by the pool on an afternoon, it was all Lebanese. And so you've got, you know, Islamic members, you've got Christian members. I mean, it is pure criminal organization and organized crime, but they rule with an iron fist. And that was why, Israel has a fairly adept presence in that part of the world. So they know what is happening with money movements and the like. And I got a bit of intel before I went from that quarter to sort of give me a heads up on what I had to be careful for. But during that whole thing, you know, I went in there, I had to have $2 million of kidnap insurance because, you know, my cover story, I'm Banker Bill from. And so the whole idea was, you know, could it be just also a scam? But these guys, let's just grab somebody who probably has access to money or money to pay to get them back. So there's a lot of, those sort of security issues front in mind. But really, the whole issue for this is that here we are. All that money came from the Federal Reserve. It's UN aid money. And there's such poor oversight over it that you have these corrupt officials who are using that money to commit all manner of financial crime. So if that money can leave the central bank that easily, what else is being done?
Right, on a global scale. And, you know, this is really quite fascinating and kind of chilling, too, because Gaddafi had been gone for six months, as you're saying. And we know that Gaddafi's execution, basically, Gaddafi had come to Secretary Clinton and the administration at the time and pleaded with the U.S. That Al-Qaeda was effectively taking over his country. He'd been providing us with legitimate hard intelligence, cooperating with the U.S. completely, and pleaded with the U.S. and even agreed to leave Libya and go to another country for asylum if that's what the U.S. wanted. So Gaddafi this whole time was trying to cooperate with Secretary Clinton and the administration doing whatever they wanted. They denied his request completely and basically set up and allowed the entire thing to come apart and Gaddafi essentially being executed, kind of a de facto assassination, really. And then we've got all these funds that you're talking about from Gaddafi left over after that that are, I guess, somehow taken possession of by the Federal Reserve, I guess, U.S. Federal Reserve, and then disseminated to the UN for so-called aid. Is that pretty much correct?
Well, I don't know about the last part. I believe that the money that I was dealing with was printed, in 2014, well afterwards. So I don't think that was physically actually Gaddafi's money. Mm-hmm. But again, the bad guys are using that as the lure. You know, yeah. All this unknown vast sums of money, like the El Dorado, you know, does it really exist?
So, well, and Inspector Michael, that you just made a tremendous point, because that money was not from the reserves of Gaddafi. That was actually printed from the U.S. Federal Reserve. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. That is correct.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Do you have any idea what sort of knowledge that the U.S. State Department and others had of this entire transaction? Or I imagine this was kind of at this point in the hands of organized crime based on what you were seeing.
Yeah, definitely it was in the hands of organized crime. I think that the problem is so vast, and in this, in, you know, many parts of the world, you don't know who you can trust. So there's sometimes an absence of timely intelligence or even sharing of good information. Uh-huh. But it's fair to say that the U.S. authorities had zero knowledge, to my knowledge anyways, had zero knowledge about what was being done with the money that they provided to the United Nations and in turn going as so-called aid money to rebuild these African countries.
So it looks like the Federal Reserve printed this money to send to the United Nations for aid money. Then the UN took it and disseminated it, and then it just went into the hands of organized crime from there.
That's my belief.
Yeah,
for sure.
Okay. Yeah, and we're talking billions of dollars here, if I'm understanding that correctly.
Well, at least in this case, I can say it was certainly that there was $80 million. US $100, and you know, they provided photographs of three such crates, but one we were able to take $600 out of and as samples. They didn't blink an eye to us taking it out, and then of course we were able to verify it wasn't counterfeit, and that the serial numbers came back, and they were able to track where it was sent from, in the US, which bank, and how it came into being there.
Tremendous job, and of course HSBC was brought before the intelligence communities and committees, and they had been laundering, I guess, billions of dollars through drug connections in Mexico, and on and on and on it goes. And HSBC crosses paths with this this entire thing with Libya and Gaddafi and the money, and as we know, the entire country of Libya now is essentially is in the hands of the Muslim Brotherhood, and has been taken largely over by radical Islamic groups, including Al Qaeda. And the place is effectively gone. What's really, as you know better than I, this is just a global web of corruption and money laundering that goes off in several different directions. And with Libya, in this case, as you're telling us, kind of at the center in terms of organized crime and money laundering here, and it is just absolutely bizarre. Now that it, another. Really important point here, I think, that you found in your investigation, that some of these funds essentially went to this Saudi bank, which has been and is well known for funneling funds to Al Qaeda. Was that a part of this also that you came across in your investigation?
Well, when I was in the Ivory Coast, didn't see that connection to the Saudis. But again, 8 months earlier, I was meeting through a totally different channel. I was introduced into it actually from, like I say, government level in the GCC, which is the Gulf Cooperation Council of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Oman, UAE, and Qatar. But so on their behalf, they wanted to know the provenance of the money because they were considering bringing it into one of their Islamic banks in their country. Mm-hmm. But you know, we're mindful you know, the source of the money and what are some of the practicalities about it. So that's why I went into Saudi. But the meeting I had was again with a family member right at the head office of the Islamic Bank that was the very next day implicated with HSBC for laundering tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars that was funneled into Al Qaeda and other terrorist Islamic extremist groups.
So that's phenomenal because in a lot of the articles about HSBC, you don't hear this, that HSBC in conjunction with the Saudi bank was also involved in the possible funneling of hundreds of millions of dollars to Al Qaeda itself. So not only was HSBC laundering money from drug cartels in Mexico, but now we've got them essentially laundering money that wound up in the hands of Al Qaeda, which is just mind blowing.
It is mind blowing, and you know, I can't help but question why, when I see some of these large bank fines, you know, HSBC got $1.9 billion, BNP Paribas got $9.5 billion fine. You know, and again, part of the reason for these large fines was, you know, you helped Iran, BNP, for example, to move illicit funds for the Revolutionary Guard, and we can trace some of those monies that that were used to fund the bombing of the Beirut barracks where the 200 plus Marines were murdered. And so my logic is, why is writing a check that all shareholders have to provide? Why is it that banks can get tax breaks because of these fines? So they're actually not paying it on a net basis. And yet 200 to 250 Marines are murdered and nobody goes to jail. Nobody in the bank is held accountable. I mean, I can't help but wonder why nobody goes to jail. Why is it that people just write checks and the world keeps on going?
Oh, and this Inspector Mike, you just nailed it again. And as I mentioned that when we opened up the program, no one at HSBC went to jail. No one was indicted. Everybody walked. They got hit with a fine for HSBC that was so small. It was like a blink of an eye in their budget. And everybody with money going to terrorism and to Al-Qaeda and to cartels in Mexico and on and on and on, even the U.S. Congress allowed HSBC just to walk with a pittance of a fine. And the point you're making, which is so important, is these big banks are engaged in global criminal activity that resulted, in the case of the Marine barracks, in the horrific death of U.S. troops, and no one was charged, no one was jailed, and no one was indicted. That's such a critically important point.
Yeah, no, this world. I always talk, Kevin. This world is divided into three groups of people, and I can certainly tell you, when I started my career, especially on the covert side, I had a very, I wouldn't say Pollyanna view of the world, but you know, it was more, I thought of the world as a more noble place, that people that were my bosses had a purity of purpose to what they did. Mm-hmm. And I realized as I went into my career that was a wrong assumption.
Same thing happened to me. Yeah, go ahead.
and you know, the best words of advice, my trainer, when I joined the Mounties, he gave me wonderful advice. And he says, two pieces that I've never forgotten. One was, he said, Bill, I'm going to come back to you at the end of your career, and I'm going to ask who you despise the most. I'll guarantee you it won't be a bad guy, won't be a criminal. And he's absolutely right. Criminals can never betray your trust. Only your own kind can betray your trust.
You know that is so important, because when you've got people of integrity and really high-level credentials, many of us, including you all with the RCMP, you go into government service loving your country, loving your constitutional documents, and thinking that you're going to go in and you're going to find some God and country patriots or people that are really devoted to serving the government. And the higher up you get, you find that is certainly not the case. That these people, they're not concerned necessarily about the noble goals that you were when you came in at all. It gets into corruption and narcissism and self-promotion. And by the end of your career, you're like, what is that famous quote? We found the enemy and the enemy is us.
Absolutely.
Which it can be really disconcerting, but I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and you know, you hit on the word, you know, the second piece of advice my trainer gave to me, he says, Bill, look, you could have a good career here. You come in well-educated. You've got a unique background from financial markets. And he says, but look, he says, if you want to get promoted, if you're, the reason you joined the Mounties is to get promoted, understand something. You have to be prepared to compromise your integrity if you want to get to the top. Mm-hmm. And very simply, what he was meaning is, Bill, when you go in front of a promotion board, don't tell them what you believe, tell them what they want to hear. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure CIA, you had the same issues. Anybody in a military or paramilitary organization where you have this command and control structure, you know, you're not seen as a team player if you voice a contrary opinion. Now, I understand.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I understand the concept that, hey, you know, once the decision's made, you know, you're all pulling in the same direction, and that's fine. But there comes a point where you know, things that are wrong, you have to address them. And I was known as somebody who was a bit outspoken about wrongdoing. In fact, I remember, Kevin, I was on the money laundering unit. And there was some problems. The officer in charge, it was a vacant position. We had two staff sergeants who were running the unit in the acting role. And you know, we as a unit saw, you know, a lot of nonsense going on. And anyways, an audit was being done, both an operational audit of the files to make sure they're conforming with policy, and also administrative, which was the money and the administration of the unit. And so everybody was told they were going to be interviewed by the audit team. And the week before the audit team came in, one of the staff sergeants called me into his office. And he says, look, Bill, the audit team's coming next week. You're going to be interviewed. When they ask you how everything is, you're to tell them everything is fine, sir. Because it would be an officer doing it, a commissioned officer. I said, okay, understood. And I understood the threat he was making to me. Uh-huh. Sure enough, next week, the audit team comes around, taken into the office to be interviewed. And I remember the fellow saying, okay, Bill, before we begin, is there anything you want to say? I said, sure. I was told to tell you that everything's fine, sir. And he said, well, what do you mean? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, last week I was called into so-and-so's office, and he told me to tell you this. And he said, well, why do you think he said that? I said, I'll tell you why. I said, these guys are taking trips belonging to, you know, for many guys in government, getting a trip is one of the perks. Mm-hmm. And so on the backs of others who did the work, they were pulling rank, taking these exotic trips to China and other places. In the units, some of these operational units, you have what's called RO 580 money, which is secret money. So it doesn't go through the normal stream. It's protected. Uh-huh. It's used to paying informants. It's used for undercover operations, buying evidence, whatever. But it's secret money. And I was the only guy on the unit who had an HQ number, meaning I was a trained undercover operator. And so you got your funding came from different channels that was outside the unit scope. And so these guys said, hey, Bill, we want you to go and it's nice summer, go rent a Mercedes. And these guys just drove it around. These guys gave themselves what's called a DR number, which is a temporary undercover number. If somebody is not trained, but they had a particular skill set that was needed for some element of an operation, they say, okay, we'll give you a DR number so we never refer to people by name, but also to fulfill a very limited role or scope on a sensitive investigation. What these guys did, they gave themselves DR numbers, and these two guys were buying suits and buying on the clothing and doing it all through RO 580 money, the secret money, and they're signing off in each other's requisitions. So I of course explain all this, and you know, when the interview is finished, you know, off they go, and I happen to say to somebody in the unit, how did it go? And I told them what I said. And they said, oh man, you're going to be in trouble. And man, truer words were never spoken. About 3 weeks later, I come into my office and my desk is empty. And I see a sergeant there. He says, Bill, I came in over the weekend by the staff sergeant that I reported on. He'd ordered him to do a statutory or criminal investigation into my activities. They took my notebooks, my computer, looking for stuff where I'd done wrongdoing. Of mm-hmm. course, no wrongdoing, and it went nowhere. But did I see any of these staff sergeants punished? No. I mean, morale in our unit was so low, and again, organizationally, they just covered it up. And in fact, once these audits are done, the unit's supposed to get it, so you get the results, and it's sort of open. They sealed this one. They made it protected B, and nobody in the unit had access to it, and yet nobody saw any accountability. That was my real first taste of my God, what's going on here?
Well, that is quote unquote the system. I'm giving a speech at the end of this month on how the government silences good patriotic employees, federal employees and agencies, how they silence them when they find criminal activity. There's an exact process that they use, and it's exactly what they used on you. I can relate so much to that because when I was an officer at the CIA, and I was able to get some of this in my book, which was not difficult or not easy. It was difficult. We got it in there. But when I was at the CIA, I was doing an international investigation, and I came across a vulnerability that was in all of our embassies overseas, where a foreign intelligence service or a terrorist organization, for that matter, could go in into that foreign embassy and identify the names and identities of our covert agents in that country, which, of course, means they can identify the assets they're connected to and everything else. So I submitted my findings to CIA management three times. The documents were lost, allegedly, three times. I'd call and they'd say, well, we never got your investigation. One day I'm sitting at my desk. I get a call on the internal line from the head of this division responsible for this. And this sinister voice says, I am ordering you to drop this investigation. And I said, well, sir, you know, I understand the concern here, but we've got the lives of our agents potentially at risk here. And he said, I am ordering you now to drop this investigation or you're going to face the consequences. Phone hangs up. I'm like, what was that all about? I go into the main headquarters server looking for my investigation and it's been erased and removed from that server. All of my documents had been destroyed. And it went on and on from there. Eventually, we took the investigation outside to a senior official outside the CIA. And they found out that it was 10 times worse than even I thought. And so, I attended a meeting where senior CIA officials were officially rebuked by this other agency for putting the lives of their agents at risk. The report was issued to the entire intelligence community. And I sat there at that conference room table, kind of with a career laser dot on my chest, thinking, well, I guess that's it for me. And sure enough, I was placed on a base where my family and I were exposed to toxins. I'm filing reports trying to get back to headquarters. And guess who they put in charge of that entire base and of me? The same officer that was in charge of this cover-up who had been rebuked at this meeting wound up being my boss on this base and just went bad from there. And you know, you say, oh, well, you still believe in your organization and its nobility. And you say to yourself, well, they would never do this. And then they do it. And then you say, well, they wouldn't do this again. And then they do it. And you get to this point later in your career where it's so disillusioning that this type of absolute corruption is at the top of these organizations.
Absolutely. It's for people who aren't in and experiencing this, it sounds like something out of a movie plot and that it's a one-off. And then you come to realize it's not.
Yeah,
you've got organizational psychopaths who have climbed the ladders of these organizations.
Absolutely.
You know, the same way that we see in banks, these rogue traders who bankrupt the bank because they went out to commit a fraud, but they made a bad trade, they made a mistake, and then they can't admit it, so they keep doubling down to sort of cover up their trading loss, and then it just mushrooms, and so you get these spectacular multi-billion-dollar losses to a bank. It's the same logic of when somebody in organizations like ours, they've had a screw up or it's going to reflect poorly on them for their assessment and promotion. And so they start doing exactly what happened to you. I would, you know, the mindset is it is better to sacrifice people I don't know than sacrifice my own career.
That's right.
So they start covering it up and protecting it. And, you know, what's the unfortunate reality? I think there was a time. And I'm not sure it exists today, to be honest, where there really was a purity of purpose to what a lot of people went into and what they did.
Yes.
But today, you know, we used to have a saying, and it was drilled into us when we joined the Mounties. We trained as a 32-man troop. You know, you went through, you lived in barracks 6 months, and they used to always tell you, you're only as strong as your weakest link. And that's the problem. We now, we work towards the lowest common denominator. We don't work to the highest. And in the name of diversity, or whatever you want to call it, we are hiring spectacularly incompetent people.
That's true.
And even worse, we're promoting them because we need to reflect CIA or we need to reflect an RCMP or FBI that is reflective of the larger community. Well, the problem is the best don't always come from these various communities. And for years, you know, we were wondering were we infiltrating the bad guys or were they infiltrating us?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and Inspector, you hit an important point. I saw this over and over. I even wrote an article about it. I would sit on promotion panels in the CIA and I'd see officers that were top ranked on their performance appraisals, just absolutely totally dedicated. And they were denied promotions just because they wanted to adjust the demographics. And then they would bring somebody in. We had to pass the equivalent of the graduate records exam to become an officer, which is not easy. But later on, they decided, well, to adjust these demographics, they would eliminate that exam requirement and get people in with that exam to just to adjust the demographics in the organization. And what started happening is we started getting unqualified people in management positions, and the place started getting dumbed down. And this has nothing to do with equal opportunity. Everybody is for that. This has to do with kind of a social experiment that's happening both in the Canadian and U.S. governments that is dumbing down a lot of organizations, and it defies complete logic. But I think you're absolutely right there.
No, it's just, you know, the value of an institution to me means a sense of permanence. It doesn't wave in the wind, what direction should I go today? You know, it stands resolute. And that's what the CIA, I think, once was. That's what the Mounties once was. It was a venerable institution. Today, it's mired in scandal and sordidness. There's all manner of poor behavior. And yet, if you look at it, if you had a graph, that graph totally would go in the same direction as when all this sort of social engineering started taking place.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
When the politicians started telling the guys in the business who you have to hire to do your business and who you have to promote, having no sense of it. You know, I make a joke of it. You know, when I flew over from Hong Kong, I'm here in Canada now for vacation, but you know, I said, you know what, I'm going to go up to the, when I get on the airplane, I'm going to say, you know what, today I identify as a pilot. Is it okay if I fly the plane? You know, of course they're going to say no, but we now live in this world that I want to be a CIA officer, and utterly incompetent. I'm physically unable to do it, but you know, it's really what I want to do. You know, there's going to be some idiot who's going to say, you know what, you should live your dream. Come on in and maybe you could, you can run a team in Afghanistan for us and see what happens.
Right. You'll fit in our social experiment. And what I saw over and over was, well, and I actually had supervisors tell me this, well, we're too afraid of an EEO suit. We don't want to get sued. Well, but this person is not performing there. Well, that doesn't matter. We don't want to get a suit, so we'll just let it go. And you know, that component comes into it. So you got this social engineering going on. Then you got the threat of these lawsuits that'll cost tens of thousands of dollars. And most careerists will just roll over and let that happen. And as you're describing, too, it's dumbing down these organizations. And when you do that, it affects the safety and security of that organization. And ultimately, the safety and security of our prospective country. So it's not a small thing.
No, not at all. You know, again, you're not going to let somebody who just wants to be a dentist do a root canal on you unless you know they're properly trained and suited for
right.
the job.
Right.
And yet, when it comes to security, which is fundamental security. Without it, doesn't matter how rich you are. Doesn't matter how smart you are. If you're going to be blown up. If you're going to be harmed, you know, you look at us as a society, what is going on? You know, are we living in a free open society when you're encouraged to put alarms on your homes and to put bars over your businesses?
Uh-huh.
We never used to do that before. I mean, rather than lock up the wrong people, we're jailing ourselves in uh-huh. behind gated communities, in behind alarm systems. I mean, it's gotten to the point that it's your fault if you left something in your car and somebody breaks into your car to steal it. Why did you leave it there in the first place?
Right.
We have right. lost this sense of accountability and responsibility.
And you're so right. And in this grand social experiment that's politically happening in the U.S. and in Canada, it's removed all personal responsibility. And what it's done is not to sound Pollyanna, but in our respective countries, you know, originally when you've got a system of ethics and character and kind of a system that in that country that is the foundation, kind of foundational political belief. When you have a moral and ethical center to your country, there's that is a control on human behavior. But when you take that away and you start engaging in this grand social experiment, you have removed any constraints on human behavior, and people basically can do what they feel like doing when they feel like doing it, and the whole thing just starts to unravel. I think you're right. I think that's what we're seeing.
Well, I mean, that's my belief, and. You know, and it manifests itself in so many different ways. I can give you specific examples. Everybody, not everybody, but many people look at Bradley Manning as some type of hero. you know, Edward Snowden, mm-hmm. some mm-hmm. type of hero. I understand and I can agree with the idea of whistleblowers and getting a message out there. What I don't agree with is doing it with reckless abandon and you know, your hubris that your moral position is so strong that it doesn't matter who you hurt in the process of getting your message out there. And, you know, there's many examples where people are saying, well, how did with Bradley Manning releasing all these millions of cables, you know, how did it compromise anybody? Well, I can tell you, you know, in many ways, there's nobody on the editorial boards of WikiLeaks and many people in government, you know, who were trying to go against WikiLeaks or Snowden. But they articulated, I thought, rather poorly what was the operational damage being done. And I give you a very clear example. You know, when you're in the CIA, you know, everything you do is compartmentalized. There are things that are being done, whether it be on the human intelligence gathering or the technical gathering, where everything's on a need to know basis. And mm-hmm. some of the techniques and methodology, unless you're part of it, that's not shared with you.
Right.
And I was on the cutting edge after 9/11 to rebuild Canada's global covert infrastructure, and we did, my partner and I, and we rolled out and we actually ran banking operations globally. We set up correspondent banking relationships. We had a number of things going on, and what that really identified to me is the lack of knowledge about the infrastructure used to support covert ops, used to fund informants, relocate people who needed protection. We had all of that going on, and nobody understands that's the backbone of covert operations is the infrastructure. And when I did a job for the FBI out of Miami, and I was meeting a South African banker in one of the Caribbean islands because he wouldn't come and meet me in the United States. And this banker had offered, had already asked me, and this is in 2002, had asked me to launder discounted bonds for Libya, North Korea, and Iran. He had had me using an email system that said, look, our system is using 128-bit encryption. It can defeat the FBI Carnivore computer. And at the time, I didn't even know what the FBI Carnivore computer was, which is their computer program to basically backdoor right. all operating mm-hmm. systems. And they said, look, we have a bank over here, and we have brokerage financial services over in this other jurisdiction in the Caribbean. Look, Bill, because my story was that I had cocaine money to launder and I was generating $3 million a day in cocaine sales. I needed to clean my money. And so they were going to bring it into the brokerage firm. And as they said, look, if for whatever reason that the police are coming to knock down our door, we can hit a button and do what's called a hot swap. And your data is sent immediately to the bank in the other jurisdiction, and that all that's going to be found on our computer records is benign information, nothing to do with your real accounts and real money. And so when I would go to meet this guy, the FBI says, look, we don't trust the police in the jurisdiction where you're going, so we're not going to notify them that you're going to be operating covertly over there. And so what we need to do, Bill, is get the permission and the clearance from the ambassador, the American ambassador in the countries you're traveling to. And so they need to know your real name and as Bill Miker. But they also then need to know your covert name and the covert companies that you're operating under for the very simple reason that if something happens, the ambassador has to be fully informed so he can then deal with the political fallout if something goes awry. And so that all gets sent out in cables. And when we were setting up the covert infrastructure, you know, that all went out in cables to our embassy staff. They didn't know who we were or what we were asking for, but we had a game plan. And so we were dealing with people in the business development areas and to say, look, who's a lawyer that's not going to ask questions in this jurisdiction? What's the difficulty if we were to do this or that, you know, and we, even with our own government people, we were using covert names. So there
was, you're making an important point here, and we got about 10 minutes to go, but you're making a really important point, and I'm glad you brought it up in terms of the whistleblower category, because you got kind of a double-edged sword. You have a Bradley Manning, and he's being described as a hero. You know, Bradley Manning, when you dump a bunch of information because you got an attitude or you've got an axe to grind or you're angry or whatever, that's not a whistleblower in my view. And then you got the other side of that coin, and Thomas Drake, who was the NSA employee who came across the Thin Thread Trailblazer program, and where they were wasting $7 billion, went through the normal channels at the NSA to try to, and also the select intelligence committees, to alert them that the NSA was not only wasting $7 billion, but also this program was monitoring U.S. citizens. Thomas Drake went through the system, wound up having his house raided, and then was charged with espionage, which he eventually beat. So you got that one side of the story, and then you got Bradley Manning, who just in my view doesn't fit. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I really wanted to say this does not fit my perspective of a whistleblower that just got disgruntled and dumped a bunch of stuff. And so people can sort that through, I guess, and have their own opinions, but. There are true whistleblowers out there, and they usually wind up getting really, really targeted. But there are some that are not either, and that's a valid point, I think.
Yeah, 100%, I agree with you. And you know, again, one person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist. But people who haven't fought the fight, people who haven't placed themselves in the harm's way, I'll take their opinions after. I'll take the opinions of somebody who's been at the pointy end of the spear, and Bradley Manning wasn't at the pointy end of the spear. If any reporter ever had to work to the standards that you or I would have had to work with in terms of dealing with real evidence, they'd never have a story to go on, because, right. You know, I mean, the media can run with any story, twist it any way they want, put the word in alleged rather than say they did it, you know, a little bit of, verbal judo, and they can talk something that's nothing but nonsense.
And you're right. And there's also the untold story of who on earth let all that information sit on a server where a private in the army who had already had some behavioral issues, performance issues, where a private can go in and download all that stuff from the server. We don't know this because it may have happened internally, but you didn't hear that anybody in the U.S. Army, Department of State, or anywhere else was held accountable for that amount of data just sitting out there where a private could download it onto a CD and pump it out to the world, you know. Talk about negligence on the part of whoever was in charge of that information control. It's just astounding. But, of course, that's the part that you never heard of.
Right. That's really, I mean, Bradley Manning is the tip of a very ugly iceberg. You know, you have 2 million people with, you know, with fairly high security clearances. How do you have 2 million people with high levels of security clearances? And that's why you're getting all these leaks left, right, and center. People aren't being properly vetted anymore. We've lost the sense of what is secret, what is top secret, you know, cosmic. It doesn't matter the classification. But but there was a point in time when people paid attention to that, and it was career ending if you didn't pay attention. Now, I can't tell you how many guys have left laptops in cars to get them stolen, and it's got all sorts of sensitive information on it. And now everybody's doing, spending an inordinate amount of time doing damage control, when if you just deployed proper procedures, you wouldn't have those issues.
Well, again, and then, you know, people see what's going on at the top as kind of the hypocrisy, whatever you want to call it. You know, Hillary Clinton's got this secret server in her basement where she's processing official Department of State information, some of which was without a question classified. Some was imagery intelligence related to overhead reconnaissance of Libya. 33,000 emails. And it's funny how this gets back to HSBC. Clearly, James Comey comes out and lays out the case for Hillary Clinton's indictment, whereas someone who just leaked the cable at a lower level would have been immediately charged, terminated, or worse. Comey lays out the case for Hillary Clinton, who not dumped, she had a secret server in her basement that no one even knew about. There's some people think the president did, but anyway, Most government officials didn't know she was processing all of her official correspondence out of this secret server. She walks, no charges, no indictment, no nothing, not even a slap on the wrist. And James Comey just lets her walk. Well, it turns out we know now that James Comey was a senior board member of HSBC when all this money laundering was going on. And we also know now that the Clinton Foundation was also connected to HSBC. And your point was so good in the beginning of the program. This international global kleptocracy, this massive money laundering self-promotion thing, has its tentacles all the way into most governments, the UK without a doubt, the United States without a doubt, and I'm sure probably Canada in your estimation. But this stuff, this high-level money laundering corruption, these officials engage in this stuff, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, no one has ever indicted, no one has ever charged, and I think I agree with what you said. It's because this global organized system is at such a high level and involves so many high-level officials in these governments that they just block not just investigation but any charging of any of these individuals, and they engage in this stuff and they walk. HSBC is essentially connected to funneling money to terrorists, and they're not charged. They get a pittance of a fine, and their management walks, and no one is held accountable. I mean, it is just mind-boggling, Inspector, that this system is occurring in these governments, but it's clear that it is.
Absolutely, it is, and you know, so much so that I am today. I have two young daughters, and I am of the view today that I will refuse when my children grow up. I want to go work for government. I want to be at the pointy end of the spear, Dad. I'm going to say, no way, your country doesn't deserve your blood. Your country doesn't deserve your sacrifice. That's how I feel today.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had my son say, you know, Dad, you know, I want to go to work for the CIA and do what you did. And I said, son, don't do it. You know, it's not what it used to be. It's not what you think it is. You know, if you want to serve your country nobly, I think you should go somewhere else. And Inspector Micah, isn't that a sad commentary that we have to say that now about our own agencies, that they've degraded to such an extent? It's a sad commentary. It really is.
Well, it is a sad commentary, and I think it's reflective of what I started saying at the beginning of our interview, and I forgot to make the point that the world is divided into three classifications of people in my view, and at the very top of that food chain is the 0.01%. That's the George Soros of the world. It's the Bloomberg. It's, you know, it's the mm-hmm. people who have probably 80-90% of the world's wealth and, mm-hmm. and influence. They're the 0.01%. Then you get the 1%. And the 1% are the professional class, the lawyers, the accountants. Mm-hmm. You know, guys like me and you, when we leave government, if you go to work for these firms, you know, investigative or engineer, professional services, that 1% is, you know, there's a nice bandwidth. Millionaires are in there, but you're serving that 0.01%. Then the other 98.9% of the world is basically the deplorables, the great unwashed, those yeah. people who are just fodder for our egos and our narcissism. Yeah. And governments and institutions, there's a direct correlation. And I go back what I call self-interest. The self-interest, both of an organization, of an individual, will always override all other considerations. Uh-huh. And like yourself, I picked up that, you know, I didn't realize that Comey had once been a board member of HSBC. And you know, what really astounds me, you know, he's a lawyer. And you know, when the $1.9 billion fine came down for criminal money laundering, who did it go to? It went to a couple other U.S. you know, the monitorships. You know, mm-hmm. to be combating all this. Well, they're making about $100 million a year.
Yeah.
Monitor. And again, who's paying for that? All the users of the bank in higher fees and higher rates to cover all this. But it's going to a legal kleptocracy that exists for the lawyers.
Exactly. And I don't mean to interrupt you. I think you just summed it up, Beauty. You just nailed it. We've run out of time. Inspector Micah, I wish we could go on further, but your last few statements, I think you just nailed it. You just summed it up beautifully. I think it's been a tremendous interview. I think we hit on some important points in your last statements. I hope the audience will remember when you described the personality types of these people and who were involved in this sort of kleptocracy. We've run out of time. Inspector Micah, outstanding interview. I'm so honored and pleased that you came on. And I want to thank you for coming on the Intelligence Hour, and hopefully we can have you on again in the future.
It'd be a great pleasure, Kevin. And I've read your book, and you've had a challenging but fun career, and it's a real thrill to speak with you on the show as well.
Awesome. Thank you, Inspector Mike. I appreciate it. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Look forward to it. Take care.
Thank you. You too. Bye. Ladies and gentlemen, that is our show for tonight. We hope you gained some important information as we work towards defending the constitutional foundation of our government. As we can see, that's quite a challenge. Remember, you can catch me on my Facebook page, From the Company of Shadows, my Twitter feed, @Kevin_Shipp, S-H-I-P-P, or check out my book, From the Company of Shadows, on Amazon.com. If you have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at intelligencehour@gmail.com. That's intelligencehour@gmail.com. If you'd like for me to come and speak at your group or organization, just send a note to intelligencehour@gmail.com and put Attention Business Manager in the subject line. As we close out this edition of the Intelligence Hour, as always, I leave my audience with the famous quote attributed to Thomas Jefferson. When people fear their government, there is tyranny. When the government fears the people, there is liberty. And remember, it's the Constitution that keeps us free, and it's faith, family, and friends that make life really fulfilling, and that is real wealth. This is your host for the Intelligence Hour, Kevin Shipp, signing off, and we'll see you next week.